This week's episode of Gallifrey Public Radio discusses sensitive subject matter and may use explicit language. Listener discretion is advised.
The 456 have made their demands, and we realize just how messed up government really is. This week we talk Day 4 of Children of Earth. But first, your hosts. I'm Jay Witten.
Are we talking adult like Torchwood or adult like Cinemax after 11 p.m.?
And with me are Melissa Mazza.
I demand to be referred to as Sagacity from now on.
And Keir Hansen.
The jockstrap of Rassilon is formidable and large.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 53 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we have a moment of silence for some of the most troubling television we've ever watched. And then watched again. And then, because we're masochists, watched again. Of course, we're talking about Children of Earth. We're on day 4 today. I'm Melissa, here with Jay and Keir. How are you guys tonight?
Excellent.
Very good, very good. Well, relatively speaking.
Yeah, as good as you can be.
Yeah. See,
apparently, I'm in a very self-deprecating mood this week, because not only am I rewatching Children of Earth, but I decided early on this week, you know what? I want to go back and reread the Hunger Games trilogy.
It's the feel-good marathon.
Oh, yeah. So I finished Mockingjay and then sat down to watch Day 4, and I'm like, I'm just, seriously, somebody get me a razor, for the love of God.
Why would you do that
to yourself? I don't know.
We're going to round it out by watching The English Patient and Dancer in the Dark. Those are all great choices.
And then Rudy, just for a chaser.
Yeah. Old Yeller for something classic.
Something for the kids.
Yeah. So Day 4. I mean, things have been getting progressively darker up to this point. And then this one, just right out of the gate, you just know things are not good.
Quite. So, because of the fact that it starts us off with the flashback that we had, we've been getting glimpses of in Day 3, and starting to get the realization that Jack has a very, well, I'm not going to say sordid past. This isn't sordid. This is outright dark. Now, I've got a question for the two of you on this. And it doesn't necessarily have to be based on when your first watch was, but really, actually, I should say more so on these rewatches, because, you know, as you start sort of telegraphing and knowing that some of these moments are coming, you start paying attention to some other things on rewatches, you know, if you're anything like me.
Mm-hmm.
What was your take after Jack finally divulges to the rest of the team what he had done at the time? And his justification in the fact that, you know, or his statement, something that I'm paraphrasing, the fact that, well, it kept them away for 40 years or however he kind of justified it. How quickly you felt the rest of the team just let that go?
Yeah, I was definitely siding with Clem on that one. As soon as he shot Jack, I was like, yes, that's the way to handle that. You know, and then, yeah, everybody else is like, oh, no, it's okay. We forgive you. It's like, I understand pressing issues, but still, that's a bit of a pill to swallow.
Right. I feel like Gwen in particular, it's okay that her relationship with Jack is such a working relationship that it's like, it doesn't matter what he did. Like, we need him right now. So I can kind of forgive her for that, because she's all business in this episode. But, like, and of course Yanto's going to forgive him, like, you know.
Yeah, but it's still, I mean, I don't care how well I know somebody. If they come up and, you know, tell me something like that, there's going to be a moment of, seriously, what the fuck? You know,
and by the way, I handed over 12 kids.
The thing is, though, like, in this episode, we finally learn that it was in exchange for an antivirus or something. Like, so there was a reason for it. I left day three really mad at Jack. In this one, you kind of understand his motives better.
Yeah, you get the explanation for it. But, I mean, you know, road to hell and all that. It's, you know, when does the means outweigh the cause, you know?
Right. Or just the fact that, you know, it's got to at least, well, it doesn't matter if it's Gwen or Yanto. In either of those cases, it's one of those things where you think you know someone, and then you find another facet to them that, while it is in the past, while there might have been a justification for it, while it might have been explained away, it doesn't change the fact that it's something you didn't know before. And that's jarring.
Mm.
You know, and I expected that to have a little bit more of an impact on just their immediate reactions to him. Like they needed to step back for a second or just kind of collect their thoughts or just, you know, file it away. I wanted to see that process of how they came right to terms with it.
Yeah, just show some kind of reaction as opposed to, oh man, that was really messed up, Jack. Okay, let's get back to business.
Yeah. Sucks to be you. Hey, look, shiny objects.
Yeah, but I mean, it just really seemed in the flashback that, I mean, present day Jack looked like he was like, I realize how messed up this was. I realize that, you know, I did a horrible thing. But the flashback Jack just seemed very businesslike, just like, okay, we're doing a job. Is it time to go home and get drunk yet? And it rubs me the wrong way every time I see it.
I did notice, and maybe this was a decision, an actor's decision on Barrowman's part, at that point where he's telling the kids, go ahead, kids, walk towards the light, it's all going to be fine. I mean, his acting seemed very wooden. I'm like, this is a horrible scene for him. He's really just hacking the hell out of this. And then I thought, well, okay, maybe that's intentional.
Yeah.
Maybe that's because he's doing something that just goes completely against his grain, and as a result, he can't even, you know, give a convincing justification to a dozen children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that did kind of cross the mind.
Yeah, it was a very good performance regardless. I mean, just because you could tell, even though it, like you said, it was kind of wooden, you could tell there was more going on behind his eyes. You know, it wasn't just like, it wasn't he showed up and decided not to act that day. You could tell he was, you know, he was planning something, like something going on, but it was just difficult to get what it was, and it just came across as very, you know, nonchalant almost.
Right. Yeah.
And you think of it, he's being a bad actor in the scene, like toward the children.
Yeah, Jack is being a bad actor. John Barrowman is doing okay.
Right. So. Actually, I wanted to. So in that scene, he calls himself Uncle Jack to the kids, and later on in the episode, Stephen, his grandchild, calls him Uncle Jack. And I just thought that was a really interesting connection there.
Yeah, just never trust any Uncle Jack ever, 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 ever.
Seriously, what ever. A creepy name.
So yeah, once we see that, you know, obviously Clem loses it and shoots him, which, hey, good on you. You know, and then then
Clem is justified in anything that he wants to do. After everything he's been through, he can do whatever the hell he pleases.
Yeah. So, but then we start to see more of what's going on with the 456 and the delegation that's there. You know, they invite Frobisher in to see what, you know, what's going on in there and whatnot. And we come across one of the children from 1965.
Suspended. Now, the state and condition, I am not gonna linger on this, because if you do, you just get absolutely skeeved out.
It's a spiral.
They, you know, some of them were asking whether or not the child was conscious, or whether they were aware of anything, or whether they were feeling pain. The 456 obviously said that they were that they felt no pain, but that doesn't mean necessarily that they are not cognizant of what was going on around them or how much time has passed as they were in this sort of frozen state.
And then again, it's like, you know, we're asking for 10% of your kids. No, they're in excruciating pain. It's not really going to work. You're going to tell them whatever the hell they want to hear. Mm-hmm. You know, so who knows if they were even telling the truth on that.
True.
Anyway, so then we get into the what I think is the most horrible part of this entire series, and that's the Cobra meeting afterwards, when Frobisher goes in and is talking to the general and the cabinet and the prime minister and everyone, and they're trying to come up with a plan for this.
Okay. And they're talking about, well, you know, not my kids, not my family's kids.
Yeah. And it starts off, they're trying to lowball them. You know, they're trying to bargain with them and say, oh, you know, how about, you know, this smaller price? And so they offer 60 kids. But the thing that kills me
is, units. Yeah,
60 units. I'm like, oh my God. Yeah. You know, if you're, I understand the need to separate yourself from such a horrible thing. I really do. But if you are the one calling the shots on such a god-awful atrocity, at least have the balls to call it what it is. You know, don't try and put some Novocaine on it to, you know, to numb it for yourself. It doesn't work that way.
Well, but that's a conscious effort, because if they start doing that at the top levels, then that process of obfuscation trickles down, because then they've already justified it to themselves or obscured it for themselves, so that as they have to answer for themselves later, however it, you know, proves to be, you know, they come up with this elaborate scheme or yeah. cover up or subterfuge, but they start at the earliest stages of referring to things under that certain I'm thinking 1984 here, where they're using the
double speak.
And using doublespeak to try and make sure that everything is referred to the right way. And I get the feeling that this is what they referred to, you know, 40 years hence. That's what they had established. Even at that time, they had probably, because it seemed very practiced that they were already referring to these as units. I had the feeling that that's how they filed it away back then.
Right.
Yeah, very possibly. It just that's one of the things that always is the first thing that catches me. I'm like, oh, they just called them units, you bastards.
Yeah, and then it just came across better than young meatbags.
Yeah, well, then it all kind of goes downhill from there. The 456 refuse the offer, and the children start chanting numbers. You know, and that's just that whole scene there is, I mean, that's reminiscent of when they're screaming, and you realize, you know, when they're screaming, you have no clue what's going on. You're just like, this is creepy on all kinds of levels. And then you get to this point and you know exactly what they're doing, and you're like, this is so much worse.
Right. Yeah. And it got me thinking. I'm thinking about those little tiny countries, Liechtenstein. What happened? When there's like, you know, the kid just yelling four. I don't know, just you know, some little village out in the middle of nowhere in Central Africa, you know, I don't know.
Sealand, which was like one and his wife.
Yeah, and then how do you collect those? The logistics of this were really, you know,
well, I was thinking that too. Like, how did they choose nations as their, you know what I mean? Like, that's a very human way of dividing it. Why would the 456 choose like each nation's kids?
Right. And if that were the case, and they wanted to make sure that they were going after, you know, this 10%, and they're assuming that it's 10% of the population of the nations that can be contacted through all this, that have some sort of a connection to the Western civilization or whatever, that why wouldn't they? And I know we have this explanation they've given as to why they decided to drop down in London again, but why not the UN? You know, and be able to speak to the collected nations and say, okay, you, and you. Back there, you know, you little tiny countries, you know, you can't hide from us there, Monaco. Sorry, but
I mean, that's just it. The 456 are very, like, they're using psychological warfare too.
Mm. Yeah, and that's the thing, is we don't know anything about the 456. How long have they been sitting there in orbit or something studying us, saying, okay, this is exactly how we're going to divide it up. Now let's move in and make our demand.
Which, I'm sorry, I think out of everything, you were mentioning that, you know, of what particular moments really kind of hit home and you were impacted by listening to the discussion around the Cobra meeting. For me, it really had to do with the 456's discussion of why and how they were.
Yeah, but that's not till day five.
Yeah, we're not talking about
the idea of the inviting the cameraman in and having that that poor son of a bitch.
Oh god, yeah.
Oh, talk about scarring.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not going home to his family anytime soon.
No.
So we get through our number chanting, and then we cut to poor Johnson, this misguided soul, who is obviously, there's got to be a term for this, who someone who is a blind weapon, you know, that doesn't know what they're fighting for or doesn't have the full story of what it is they're carrying out. Is there some sort of a term for this, a literary term or a term in film and television that refers to this? There has to be. In fact, listener, all three of you,
write it.
Just go out there, get back to me. You know, go ahead and tweet me later at Kier Hansen or put something on the Facebook post or something that lets me know what the term is that refers to the individual who is a sellsword, basically, who does not know the reason that they're hired for. You know, there has to be something for this, because my heart actually kind of goes out to Johnson for being as blind as she is.
I have to agree. It's like, you at the beginning, you definitely see her played up as the kind of villain, and then as time goes on, you realize she has no clue. She is a soldier who is following orders, and that's it.
When she starts out, she is the un-Gwen.
Yeah.
She's kick-ass, but she's evil kick-ass.
Exactly.
So she's Bender Gwen with a little goatee mustache.
Actually, so I, when I started this episode, I thought I, when it starts with the flashback in 1965, I thought for a minute the woman there was her. So I, you know, like, I started thinking, like, oh my god, it's her mother or something. Like, and then I was like, wait, that's not actually what happens here. I started to think of all kinds of theories. But I wonder, maybe somehow she's connected.
No. Oh, that would have been a cool twist if she was somehow, yeah, her lineage was somehow connected. Ugh, oh, that'd be awful.
Yeah, I was like waiting for it to happen, and then I'm like, wait, Melissa, you've seen this episode, it doesn't happen.
Well, so what do you guys think of the whole selection process of the 10%?
I mean, I'm with you that it's the most chilling part of the episode. When they decide, okay, so they start off with the political undesirables, the asylum seekers. Like, that was effed up to begin with. And then they say, I have a quote written down here that I forget her name, but she says, if we can't identify the lowest achieving 10% of this country's children, then what are schools lead tables for? Like, and as those are the kind of thoughts that I had in high school. Like, what are they keeping these tests for?
Well, now you know.
Exactly.
Now you know why standardized testing is bad.
That's my theory. That's what they're doing.
It wasn't like, you know, they started with a, oh, let's do, you know, a random lottery kind of thing. And you're like, all right, that's horrible and wretched, but it makes the most sense. Well, my kids aren't going to be in it. Oh, you are such a bitch. So, and then you see it start to devolve, and it comes down to that cold calculation and deciding, you know, well, a lottery is clearly out. If we're, you know, if we're going to already stack the chips, then why are we even going to bother with it?
One of the things that really kind of kills me, or actually it really kind of caught my attention, and it's one of the reasons why I'm going to completely jump genres here. Obviously, for any of the listeners who had read the book World War Z, and found that, as I did, one of the things that made that particular book interesting was the fact that it was taking these horrendous events, you know, this zompocalypse, but it was looking at it from a socio-political, economic, structural standpoint and seeing what the impact on society and government decisions were in the face of these unnatural disasters, if you want to coin a phrase. Mm-hmm. Now, this was us being able to look at, here's what the, you know, I'm doing finger quotes here, the hollow suits in government actually would talk about when it came to making the hard decisions like this, and what were some of the horrendous things that they would have to discuss and find justification and explanation for. So these kind of scenes I really got locked into, because I thought, God, this is, you know, I'll bet, obviously not in this kind of a case, but similar sort of conversations have taken place when there were decisions about military genocide or any of these sort of things, and someone had to argue the case for it and had to put some sort of an explanation forth as to why it made sense. Again, finger quotes. But the thing that really kind of killed me was when, and hats off to Russell for including this, when it really wasn't, it probably could have been omitted, but the inclusion of it had that much more impact, was the whole discussion about, well, you know, this actually does keep population growth in check.
Yeah, that statement.
That was, oh.
It's
and then I'm actually saying, you know, we could spin this in a positive sense when the shit hits the fan. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. That's a new couple of shadows across this already dark scene. Thanks much, guys.
I mean, that's the point when you're like, no, you're not allowed to look for a silver lining in this situation. There isn't one. Don't invent one. It's not going to work. Yeah.
I mean, but, I think that was just to illustrate that, like, this is how far they've come. Like, it starts out pure and noble, and then by the end.
Yeah.
I've read World War Z here, and the Heidecker plan in that. But in World War Z as well, after things have kind of calmed down, people see the wisdom in that. They, you know, it was like a necessary evil. So I think that's kind of what they're hoping.
Yeah.
Hoping here. Like, you know, not necessarily like finding the silver lining now, but.
Yeah. And that's the thing. They said something to the effect of, you know, and that'll give us some means to be able to explain to the public after after the outcry or after we faced the music. I forget how he phrased it, but it was something where they knew it was going to get hairy for them for a little while, and they were going to take a lot of shouting, and a lot of people were going to be sort of put in front of a media firing squad. But after it all, looking more long-term, they'd have some way to be able to explain it away.
Yeah.
Or allow people to pick up and move on, so to speak.
Yeah, but that definitely was one of the most chilling things, just the sheer, you know, I don't even know what to call it aside from just evil.
Mm-hmm. So we get to, we have the brief moment where Yanto, knowing he's being tapped and knowing that this information is going to work its way out to the individuals who are trying to track him and the rest of the team down, decides to take the risk of getting in touch with his sister.
Yeah.
And his brother-in-law, whom he loves, even though he's reluctant. I love you. I love the kids. And, you know.
I'm even starting to warm up. Yeah.
What was your thought on that as far as him speaking directly to those of you listening in?
Yeah, that was definitely one of those, like, yes, that is awesome. Yeah, he was. Okay.
Did you think that had enough of an effect? I almost wanted to see that have an impact.
Yeah.
No, you know what it was? I think it wasn't so much as like a plot point, but a character point, because they're building Yanto up to be so lovable. Like, you love that he does that, you know? Like, his character, really, you like him in this episode.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's just building to a tragic...
Yeah. But, yeah, I think it was just that you needed that moment to just... see Yanto, because he's always in the shadows, you know, he's always with the coffee and, you know, the support crew, and this was his moment to, you know, just be like, you know what, fuck you all, this is what's going on, you know. It was his moment in the spotlight, so to speak.
I absolutely do agree with you that on that, though, Melissa. This is one of those things where, you know, Yanto has never been the one to pull a trigger. You know, he has been there as a facilitator and as a, you know, logistician and a brilliant brewer of tea, but has never been the one to take the anger approach or to, you know, to be the one on the front lines. This is a testament to that, insofar as, you know, even for the individuals who are trying to take them out at every turn or corner them and render them a non-concern, he's still thinking of the greater good as he sees it, you know, which is the more humanitarian greater good than the government's translation of a greater good, which is everyone but us.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that's a definite character moment for Yanto.
So Yanto then calls Gwen and basically sets a trap for Johnson.
Right. Wanting to make sure that she arrives at Torchwood just at the moment where they're going to start their reveal, thinking that this is their you know, their best card in the deck they're about to play. We get back to the explanation that our government collective, our Cobra meeting, has come up with, which is, I'll say this, it's rather ingenious. Of being able to say that, okay, well, as far as the public knows right now, we just have kids that are acting erratically on a regular basis. There was some strange behavior over Whitehall. We'll tend to all that momentarily, or we'll, you know, we'll even sweep that under the rug. People are more concerned about their kids, so let's come up with something that involves their kids getting better.
Yeah,
and when things go wrong, we'll just blame the aliens.
Yeah, and I mean, brilliant move on their part.
Yeah, I mean it is actually is a pretty good strategy, you know, horrible but brilliant.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, it's, you've got to think, if you were in that situation, you know, all you know is your kids start freaking out. Sure, there's a golden pillar that shows up somewhere in England, but that's it. You don't know anything else about it. You know, maybe it was just some random weapon or something, like got fired off at the Sycorax. You know, who knows?
Darn solar flares.
Yeah.
All those solar flares.
And then all of a sudden, you've got the news coming up saying, oh, you know, we figured out what's wrong with the kids. We're going to inoculate them. Awesome. Problem solved. Yeah. So, you know, everything's coming up roses at that point if you aren't really paying attention.
Would you, as a parent, let your kid get inoculated after you heard that?
Hell no. it's difficult to say, you know, after watching everything, but I'm sorry, if you can't come and explain exactly what's going on, if you're just going to be like, no, it's a vaccine, it'll be okay, don't worry about it. No, you've got to give me some more than that. But, yeah, I know a lot of people that would just be like, oh, well, the government says it's okay, so go for it.
Yeah. That's true. Or just their state of distress in not having any explanation as to why their children have been behaving this way for this period of time. You know, for a couple of days, you've been absolutely beside yourself over the fact that you have no means of, at these intervals, no communication or no contact with your child standing right in front of you. And their behavior and all the behavior of the children around them is just so, well, foreign, that maybe you would grasp at any opportunity to set things right.
Yeah.
Or to make it stop. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to say if you haven't lived through 4 days of not knowing what's going on with your kid. And you know, once you get to that point, it might seem like a viable reason. Yeah.
Right. Especially as their behavior is getting odder and odder. It was going from, you know, just the noise to the we are coming, we are here. Now they're chanting numbers. The numbers have significance. You know, people are starting to piece that all together. And as that concern and the confusion gets greater, you might be more and more likely to say, all right, any solution, just give me something.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, yeah, absolutely brilliant on their part to disguise it that way. Like you said, it's just the perfect cover up for, you know, hey, let the aliens take the fall for it once it's all said and done. Be like, no, we took them and we don't know what happened to them. You know, it's a lot easier to say, no, we lost track of them and have, you know, deal with those repercussions than, no, we sacrificed them to the alien overlords.
Right.
You know, slight difference in, you know, repercussions there.
It's all in the tone, though.
If you say it in a happy voice, then they'll think it's a good thing.
We'll have the message delivered by Elmo. It'll all be okay.
Yeah. So
Elmo likes inoculations.
So
Elmo got a jab.
So then we get to the point where, you know, Jack knows what's going on. He realizes, you know what, these guys can't be trusted. We made this deal once before and they're back again. So we can't go with this. So he steps in, you know, walks up there with Yanto, you know, getting ready to do his Torchwood thing that, you know, works every damn time except for this.
Sure does. Well,
yeah, not so much this time. You know, these guys aren't, well, they don't take
before
it.
Before we get to this, now let's note that meanwhile, all of the chess pieces are starting to slide into their positions. Everybody thinks that they've got their best hand ready to play. Johnson arrives just in time for Gwen to say, hey, take a look at this screen. You know, all this has been recorded. And Lois puts on a great show.
Oh yeah,
you know that whole.
Sorry.
Does anybody have anything left? And she speaks up, and everyone's like, you know, just telling her, secretary, receptionist, just humor her, get her quiet, get her out of here. Did you notice that she's very nervous at first when she's explaining, you know, that they give her the setup line, you know, you and whose army? She's, oh, Torchwood.
Yep.
And starts getting
into
that.
Yeah, I have read my notes, yay, Lois, right here.
Exactly. She starts really getting bold about it for a while. And she starts, you know, as she's itemizing what's going to be done, you know, and really kind of laying it out for the rest of them, she gets bolder and bolder and bolder, and then catches herself and says, well, okay, that's about it. That's all I have. Right back down. Pew! Back down to mouse size again. But I loved it. You know, I didn't really understand, and I still don't completely understand the whole decision of using the Lois character as the vehicle anyway, but that was definitely enjoyable as far as the way that they decided to play with her reveal to the government collective there. But that's happening, obviously, in tandem with Johnson coming to the realization that she has been this blind puppet, or whatever the listeners are going to tell me the name of that trope is. And everyone says, okay, well, we got Jack in position. He's there with Yanto. They are ready to go in, and they're going to get an opportunity to drop the hammer on this. You know, we've got it all set, and that means day four ends it, and day five is going to be happy days. That's what's going to happen.
Yep.
Right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No. Well, apparently Jack found somebody whose dick was a little bit bigger than his. Jack walks in, gives his speech. Yanto chimes in, gives his speech, and it was just brilliant. You know, I mean, this was threats on doctor level intensity. You know,
yeah. Well, in fact, even referencing the doctor.
And then the 4-5-6 say, "No, we're not playing this game." They lock the building down and pump it full of poison.
So what was it that they did to Clem? Because the other people didn't seem to like bleed out of their ears and stuff like he did.
It was the I think
coming
that,
across that frequency or that that signal that that caused him to start to react. I think it was because it was in close proximity to where he was. And the whole idea of him, the shriek, that pain that they were experiencing or whatever it was that they were feeling, because that was not being broadcast as some of the other 456's messages were. This was happening to one of them. And just because the audio video feed was connected and Clem was in the room hearing that, that had its effect on him. If there were another child in the room at the time, you would have seen the both of them go down.
Probably, yeah. Was that in this day or was that day four or day five?
This was in four, where the where the shots are being fired at the tank. You know, Yanto makes his threat to shatter the tank and thus, you know, suffocate them. But when they start to shriek, you know, Clem hears that and, you know, clutches his ears and starts to bleed from the ears and so forth. That's the I think it's just because he was the only one within, you know, quote unquote, earshot.
Yeah. Yeah. But that, I mean, that was.
It shots. Sorry. I'm trying to make light of this because this is a rough episode.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that part was brutal, too. I mean, I love Clem. He was fantastic. And then that starts to happen. You're like, stop torturing him. Stop torturing him. He's going to be so messed up when this finally stopped. Oh, dear God, it stopped. No, don't stop. Bring him back. It was brutal.
Yeah, Clem is adorable. And like, he reminds me of a cartoon character, and I can't remember who it is. But there's a cartoon character that he looks just like, and one day I'm going to be watching and be like, Clem.
That he looks like. Oh, geez. I don't know. I'm thinking about that, too. Point on this, because we're starting to get to one of our big climactic moments here. Obviously, this is a mad panic moment. There's a whole montage of everybody trying to flee the building before everything gets locked down. You know, we come to the realization, and there's the discussion between Yanto and Jack that Yanto has breathed in this airborne pathogen, whatever it is, and there's no way out of that room. Now, meanwhile, the music that is going on through this is horrifically gorgeous. Ben Foster is a right bastard for putting together not only brilliant orchestration, but his use of operatic and choral voices in this specifically to make it sound even more like some sort of a huge scale Greek tragedy is just destructive. I think if you were to actually find some way to be able to eliminate the audio track from this and just take it on the sound effects and dialogue, it would not have half the impact that it does with everything that you get through the score on this in particular. This episode, these scenes at this moment in particular.
Oh, yeah.
Because I know just watching it for probably about the third time in the past week. Why the hell did I watch it 3 times in a week? just this afternoon, I was a mess. And I think a great deal of it at this point was simply because of the score.
Yeah, I definitely have to agree with that. I mean, the music is just perfect for this, and it's just, you can't help but, like, just openly weep when it comes to this point.
Yeah, and I did note that specifically the way that it was, the way it was constructed, at the scenes where there are people banging against doors and racing through hallways or trying to make it down stairwells or trying to get out into the open and so forth, there is a chorus of these voices that are going through, and obviously you can't make out any of the words. It's all kind of a nonsense patter. But at the point where it finally comes back to Yanto and Jack and having their, you know, their final moments, all of those voices drop away down to a single singer, which is a tremendously effective strategy from a music composition standpoint, for making you feel like, you know, the sort of the last man standing kind of an emotion. It's absolutely, absolutely just devastating.
Yeah. All right. Was anyone else hoping during this whole scene, like, no matter how many times I watch it, I keep hoping that maybe this time Decker won't get his suit on in time. Asshole.
Yeah. As he's doing it, like, you're not rooting for him to lace it up.
Oh, the zipper's stuck. Damn it.
It's like, no matter how many times I watch it, I'm like, maybe this time. Maybe it'll get caught on his foot this time. Damn it, no. Maybe, no. Yeah, but anyway, so
yeah, this whole scene is just so, like,
Yeah. And then, yeah, we watch Jack and Yanto both die. You know, Jack kisses Yanto one last time before he falls over dead himself.
And I like how they kind of like, they fall in like a spooning position. It's like, Jack, you know, Jack's going to wake up, so it's almost like he's asleep here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then when he does pop up, and, you know, you've got the moment between him and Gwen, both of them crying over Yanto's body.
That was an amazing moment. You see it from Gwen, and then like, she knows that he's going to sit up. She's not even, you know.
Yeah, he pops up, and she just doesn't even react.
Yeah. How about, okay, so I want to go back to when Yanto and Jack are dying. He says, in 1,000 years' time, you won't remember me. And Jack says, yes, I will. I promise I will. This got me thinking about Doctor Who and the Doctor's relationship with his companions, and like, would he remember them in 1,000 years time? That
I think so.
Yeah, I mean,
go ahead, Jay.
The Doctor always remembers his companions. I mean, there's never been once that he's shown like, oh yeah, I remember that person. They're always like on the forefront of his thoughts. You know, he's always.
I don't get that though. I don't like. I never got that from him.
I got a feeling that, well, at the moments where he is actually referencing previous experiences, because that ebbs and flows, there are moments where that's far stronger than others as far as the way Doctor Who is written from episode to episode. And I think that's almost writer's decision as to how much of the previous cognizance he really wants to be constantly reminded of, or how much of it he kind of stuffs away. There's times when he will reference companions by personality trait, but not by name. Something where, oh, well, you know, there was a time when I traveled with someone who was a lot like you, and she was a da 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 da, you know, but it doesn't outright say. I think a lot of that, though, I chalk up to the fact that he's just a superior intellect. Now, in Jack's case, where you're dealing with a human who has an unhuman quality, or I'm not saying an inhuman quality, an immortal quality, the idea of saying that in 1,000 years he won't remember, and him assuring that he does, I think in this particular case may be valid because of the fact that with Jack, he carries so much of his guilt with him. It's his guilt that in many cases propels him. So it's almost like those singularities and those moments that he will not allow himself to forget, because they define a lot of the choices that he makes later, or the kind of a champion that he becomes later, is because of these pivotal moments and critical individuals that he's lost along the way.
I would definitely agree with that. Like, that was well put.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know, but then I think about the fact that this comes before the end of series 4 of Doctor Who. And, you know, when the Doctor, right before he regenerates and he's going around seeing everybody one last time, and he comes across Jack in the bar, and when I put it into that context, I'm kind of like, how long have you been sitting there upset about what happened? You know, how long have you been sitting there? And, you know, when you finally get this guy's name, or, you know, get to buy him a drink or whatever, it's like, it's a little bit too natural the way he goes over and starts flirting. I want to know a time frame. It's like, have you been sitting there for, you know, 60 years mourning Yanto? Okay, then it's okay to go over and flirt. Has it been 5 days? You know, it's like, I want to know.
The answer is however long it needs to be in your head to justify his behavior later.
Yeah,
insert value here.
But this is Jack Harkness. I don't know. I don't trust him. So it could be either one.
Oh no, he's dead. Hey, nice boots.
Yeah, it's I wouldn't put that past Jack.
I would. I mean, Yanto was a milestone in Jack's life.
Yeah,
or at least we'd like to hope.
Plus, I mean, his flirting might be just a coping mechanism.
There you go. That's a good justification. Let's roll with that.
He has to, because he misses Yanto so much.
All right. I'll buy it for now.
My Band-Aid is shaped like a naked body. Yours will do.
Oh, God. All right. So that brings us to the end of day 4.
Yeah. Here's the stumper, kids. You still have another day to go. all of this crap. Who wrote this series that wants to sit there and tear your heart out on day 4 of 5, jump up and down on it, sing a couple of songs, hold it up and show it to you, ask if you want a bite, throw it back down again, and then say, by the way, I'll be back tomorrow for a little bit more.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
It's a red wedding every day this season.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. So, all right. So in lighter news, we have news.
Yeah. Okay. Let's just shake it out.
Shake it out.
Day 4 is over. Okay. If you're still with us, listeners,
if you've managed not to kill yourself.
Exactly. That's about all we can take out of day 4. We're just going to step back for a moment and say, hey, in the realm of the Hooniverse here, we've got some other stuff going on. So let's talk about some happy things for a little while. And by the way, you should all be queuing up something on Netflix to watch something animated. Watch something fun. I suggest
Adventure Time.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, if you're currently chemically altered, go ahead and watch Adventure Time. That's fine. If you're not, I suggest something like Bob's Burgers or Chowder. Those are good ones that you can get on Netflix. Those are enjoyable.
Or if you're stuck with just Hulu and you don't have Netflix, you can now watch Doctor Who.
Hey, you can.
Yeah. Good segue, Jay.
I try. Thanks for pointing it out. That really helps with the smooth transition.
It's a compliment.
But yeah, so apparently Hulu has finally made a deal with the BBC, and they now have Sherlock, Doctor Who, Torchwood. They've got a lot of BBC shows on there now instead of just like the one or two that they had previously. I think Luther is another one that's on there.
I was hoping, I guess that's actually not through their network. Who was it that had Misfits? Any of you watch that series, Misfits?
Yeah, that was actually a Hulu exclusive.
Was that theirs all along?
I'm not sure about all along, but when I started watching it, it was. That's okay, what it said
I
at the beginning.
After, okay, no, right, no, that's legit. Because I was concerned about the fact that, well, the show kind of went off the rails for me personally after they lost the only character who mattered on the show. But yeah. I digress. Okay, so Hulu has gotten a little bit better. I know I actually got into a brief conversation with one of our listeners, about this change, and he was actually a little hesitant about it because it gets down to that idea of, as he was discussing it, the kind of the dilution of distribution channels for listeners. Specifically things like, you know, he was saying that, you know, I was saying, okay, well, this is competition. And he said, well, we've got Netflix now, we've got Hulu, we've got the networks themselves. It's gonna lead to a bit of an issue with people getting to their content without having to be scattered across multiple contracts or accounts with either free or paid services in order to get the programming that they want. And I said, well, I don't know. Does this kind of feel like that's the nature of competition? And to a certain degree, competition works out to the viewer's benefit because they're going to want to, you know, vie for contracts, find the best possible deal so that if it's freely distributed, then it's going to go towards the person with the best bandwidth or the best means of distribution to us as the public. If it's a paid service, competition works well because we're going to want to gravitate towards the best price.
Well, I can kind of understand where Shooter's coming from because, you know, for a long time, all I had was Netflix. And so it was just like, if stuff isn't out on Netflix, why, you know, just I have to go without. And then it's like, everybody's like, oh, you should watch the show. Oh, yeah, I can't. It's not on Netflix. You know, and then I got Hulu. And so it was like, okay, you know, I've got a little bit more. Then I started running into stuff that I wanted to watch. And I'm like, okay, let me spend the next like hour and a half trying to find which service, you know, supports this thing. And, you know, then by the time I finally find it, I'm like, well, I need to go to bed now. I don't have time to actually watch it, much less sign up for the account and all that stuff. So
that's true. That was his primary concern, was a matter of the cost associated with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you end up having to pay into multiple providers, then, you know, you're going to be more want to say, well, you know what, it's just not worth it. You know, I'm now in for Amazon Prime. I've got Hulu. I've got, you know, on and on. And the list grows. You know, do you have to start making decisions about what you're going to pay into and what you're going to toss the wayside?
Well, and then you run into stuff that you just can't find. Like, my wife wanted to start watching Big Bang Theory, and I searched everywhere, and I couldn't find it except for, like, you know, buy the whole season on iTunes. And I'm like, I'm not paying that much money for one show, you know, not when I'm already paying $40 for these 8 different services. You know, it's so it has its pros, but it definitely has its cons as well.
Right. Okay. But I think there's one other aspect of this which we hadn't broached, which is the idea of dealing with the piracy issue. Insofar as, you know, BBC has been trying to figure out between BBC proper and BBC America about how they were going to do their releases across the time gap and so forth. But there's always going to be the concern, especially for some of the more like the release to Netflix and things of that sort. Take Sherlock, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, something where we're dealing with not only just a matter of hours, we're talking months or close to a calendar year before, you know, certain regions get access to the content that's been freely available elsewhere. Well, you do that. You hold that carrot out at arm's length for long enough, and you're just inviting piracy. So maybe these sort of agreements are going to help, you know, eliminate or limit that a bit.
Yeah, if you give the people the stuff that they want to watch, they're going to watch it. If you don't, they're going to watch it.
Right,
you
know, we're going to get it somewhere.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's just a thing. You know, I have no problem paying for shows that I want to watch if I have the opportunity to pay for them. And if it's not, you know, $150 for 13 episodes, you know, price it reasonably and make it available, and you're going to make money off of it. But
yeah.
The only caveat I have to this is, like, I haven't checked the rest of this stuff, but I know with Doctor Who on Hulu, it's only up through Series 7A. They don't have 7B on there yet, so I don't know if this is going to be one of those things where it's next day available, like most of the stuff that they have, or if it's going to be a delayed release like Netflix. So, I mean, I think that if they really want to compete with Netflix for at least the Doctor Who audience, they have to do at least, you know, a couple day at most delay, because, you know, otherwise it's like, well, you know, I'm just going to go watch it on the BBC iPlayer with my, you know, my English computer. You know.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to go plug in my British PC right now so I can watch these.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So we're going to have to watch and see what some of the fallout is from that. You know, it's got its positives. It has its potential drawbacks, you know, but this is one of those things where as far as I saw it, it's kind of inevitable. If it wasn't going to be Hulu, then it might have been another distribution network of some sort. You know, and we've been watching how both Doctor Who and Torchwood and Luther and some of these others have been doing with Netflix. And that, to me, has been a boon for me to be able to say to other people, look, there's programming out there that you need to see, that I think you need to see, that now, thankfully, I can put into your hands and say, no, this was not, you know, a CW show. No, this was not a Fox program. This is BBC. Don't worry about it. It's not stodgy. You know, this is not, you know, something this is approachable, but I think you need to see it. Now I have a means to be able to put it into your hands.
Yeah.
Hulu and those things now give me more channels to say, and for those handful of people who say, oh, I don't have a Netflix account. Really? Netflix? Okay.
So if you're still the holdout saying that you don't want to get cable, then at least this is an option. It's possible you'll be able to see the 50th anniversary sooner than it gets on Netflix, but it's still a matter of time to see if that's how it plays out. But definitely a cheaper alternative, so keep your eye on that one.
Mm-hmm.
What else do we got here?
Well, let's do a little simple. We've talked about some of these before. Another mint decides they're going to come out with commemorative coins.
Yes.
So we had some kind of cool ones about 4, 5, 6 months back that were kind of these kick-ass sort of TARDIS coins that came in a commemorative case, and the case was actually cooler than the coin, but we're not going to discuss that.
Yeah.
New Zealand Mint decided to come out with a 50th anniversary coin, which you probably can't get access to, but I'm going to make a few phone calls and see if I can't get one anyway.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. It's just got it's got a TARDIS on one side. It doesn't show what the other side is, but
it's going to be the Mint of Rassilon, and it's actually used as part of the. No, sorry.
Yeah, wouldn't surprise me, but yeah, it's pretty cool though. So you can find the link in the show notes. Go check it out, and if you you know, have the money to drop on it and the availability, go for it. Let us know what.
Get in touch with me, and I'll PayPal you some money to get me one too.
Or, you know, at least send us an email and tell us what's on the other side, because that's gonna bug the ever living crap out of me now. Damn it.
Yeah, why don't they show it? Maybe we'll find another version.
So that you'll go and buy it just to find out what's on the other fucking side.
Wow. Angry Jay.
I want to know.
Coin smash.
Oh, anyway.
In other news, jeez.
So for those, for the listeners we've got on the other side of the pond, you've been listening to us talk about The Doctors Revisited. Well, you're finally going to have your chance to watch it. They are bringing The Doctors Revisited to the UK.
Yeah, which I think is a good thing. I'm really surprised they decided to wait as long as they did.
Yeah.
Because this is, I've discussed this with, I don't know how many people at this point, just taking the 22-minute interview segments that precede the, you know, what BBCA decided to use as their episode to exemplify each regeneration, these were pretty informative and helpful little segments. Especially for those people who said, oh, you know, I've watched a little bit of Classic Who, but there were certain ones I didn't watch because I just couldn't connect with, Colin Baker. He just seemed too angry. Or I couldn't connect with John Pertwee because it felt like a James Bond episode with time travel. Or, oh, I couldn't watch First Doctor because it was just so slow and I just couldn't get it. Well, these are great opportunities to get, you know, this insight into the production, into the casting, into the impact, in the influences that it had on future productions. And it's just really nicely done, nicely edited little pieces. And it's 20 minutes. So, yeah, watch it as you're, you know, brushing your teeth and making your coffee in the morning sort of thing. But I think it would benefit the British public as well because of the fact that they must have a huge insurgence of new Whovians in their younger generations who are hearing all of this clamor from their parents and grandparents and whatnot going on about the anniversary and saying, oh, I remember Peter Davison and blah, blah, blah. And like, who's this old bloke you're talking about, Dad? It's not funny. It's not entertaining. These shows are all bollocks. And this would give them an opportunity to say, look, this is why we watched it. This is where it came from. And this is why it's such a huge deal around the UK, I think.
I think they already know.
Yeah, that's possible, but...
But anyway, it premieres Sunday, October 12th, so...
Yes. So you got some time to set your DVRs. So. Mm-hmm. Right. Let's see. What do we got next?
By the way, we are coming up by calendar on our 9th Doctor Revisited, which I think should be fascinating because you know who's not going to appear in those interview segments or have anything to say about his experience on the program.
Yeah.
It's going to be an uncomfortable 22 minutes.
They should just hold up a little cardboard cutout with a mouth cutout with someone else standing beside you going, oh, I had a crap time. I hated the show.
Go all like SpongeBob SquarePants with the pirate captain or whatever.
Exactly. I hated my time on the show.
Yeah, we're all aware. But yeah. So let's see. We've got
good stuff.
So Moffat was talking a little bit about Capaldi. Kind of touched on this subject a little bit before, but not.
He came out. He had mentioned earlier that he or had admitted that he expected Capaldi to be able to hold on to his accent or some segment of his accent. I took away from this little interview, and just to kind of summarize, he basically said that, you know, don't expect to see, you know, each regeneration has a very distinct personality change. It's one of the things that makes it characteristic of the Doctor's journey across, you know, this span, is that you're going to get a very different personality, very different response, very different interaction with each Doctor along the way. So don't expect, you know, the goofy, lighthearted quips and joviality of Matt Smith to come spilling out of Capaldi's mouth. He plans on, as far as he was describing it, to really tap into the aged, wizened, and in his words, fierce aspect of Capaldi's age and what he can bring to the character. I think the accent, me personally, I think if he's able to kind of put the roughness back into his brogue, that facilitates that.
Yeah, definitely so.
It's like getting yelled at by the I can't believe I'm blanking on the janitor from The Simpsons.
That's exactly who I was thinking.
Willie. Oh, it's haggis time. Oh, it's great. It's not gonna be quite that thick, but
yeah, just get that seriousness into it.
Yeah, it's got that edge.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. I can't wait. I'm still.
Yeah, I'm really excited.
All right. And then leading into the 50th anniversary, we've got some news about that. Apparently there was a classic Doctor protest. I'm not sure what the story is behind this exactly. Like, we've got a picture of Peter Davison and Sylvester McCoy out front of the BBC with signs saying, you know, no classics, no 50th. I'm sure this was just like a publicity stunt or like a prank or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, I originally picked up on this as a result of something that IO9 and Blaster had put out where according to, well, they had actually pulled the story from Doctor Who TV. They were mentioning that at some point while this little unannounced event was going on, that there was a third Doctor there as well. Colin Baker was also outside the doors holding up one of these goofy signs. Now, their theory is that this was a kind of a tongue-in-cheek little poke at the fans for giving him flack that there was no confirmed involvement of any of the classic Doctors in the 50th anniversary episode. Well, there's a problem with that, mm-hmm. because let's see, this news broke, as we're recording here, a little over a week ago. And just a few days ago, we come to find out another little piece of interesting information.
Yeah, that apparently Peter Davison has a copy of the script for the 50th anniversary that has his name embossed on it and everything like that.
And why else would he have a script with his name on it?
Well, it's because his son-in-law is in it.
Right, yeah. So of course you've got to give the father-in-law his personal copy.
Yeah, well.
It's tradition.
It's a special scenario, okay?
But this leads to a couple of things. It could be handled subtly, or it could be something overt. If it's a matter of they decide to just use a really quick segment, and just as sort of a quick quick edit montage, throwing past or delivering a new line of some sort, and just saying that it's a memory that one of the current, I say either 11th 10th or 11th, picks up on and just taps into one of his own memories, so to speak, and sees himself, the fifth in this case, mentioning something that he needs, then that's great. Okay, nice little tip of the hat, that's great. But after this little staged publicity stunt, which just, I'm sorry, it feels way too staged because there weren't a lot of pictures of it. It was just this odd little thing that, like a flash mob involving three previous Doctors. Well, if Davison is now coming out and saying and mentioning the fact that he's got a copy of the script and is, in, as he phrased it, involved in some capacity, but wasn't going to go into what extent that was, then might that not mean that Sylvester or maybe even Colin in this case might also have similar involvement?
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine that they were doing that protest as anything other than, like, I can't think of a scenario where it's not staged. So I have to say, we're calling it now, I think that they will all three be in the 50th in some capacity.
Okay.
It might be, like, I'm kind of worried it's going to be, like, a not actually playing themselves, but, like, the cameo a featured roles. Extra. And like, what was that?
Is it cameo roles?
Yeah, or, like, not even. Just, like, the guy sweeping the floor. Like, oh, my God, that was Peter Davison. Like, I just hope they don't go that direction with it. Yeah, but I agree. These two news stories kind of feed off of each other. Like,
yeah, it's...
And everyone else has lied about whether they're going to be in it. Billy Piper, like,
lied right up until the day when she walked on set. Yeah. Well, when I was at Dragon Con a few weeks ago and I got this chance to see Davison and McCoy speaking on a panel together, someone had asked them, obviously, about, you know, their thoughts on not being involved. Or one of the questions was something about, you know, if you were to be involved in the 50th, what capacity would you want to see yourself, you know, in there? And they both had a very quick reaction about, oh, you know, if we were asked, we'd be there in a heartbeat. You know, we're absolutely committed to the program and its legacy, and we'd love to be asked. Wink, 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 wink. And they were trying to make jokes about it, saying, you know, oh, please, someone ask us. Oh, no, stop. Oh, yes, please, stop. No. Oh, yes, no, stop. But it seemed, you know, a kind of a, in retrospect now, at least on Davison's part, kind of a, he thinks the lady does protest too much. Uh-huh. But they were both reacting so quickly and so similarly that you would think that they both were on the, you know, in the know about something that we've not been exposed to yet. So I would like to say at least I think that McCoy is involved. I don't know about Baker, just because people don't really know how to get along with him.
Wait, from which Baker? Because apparently they're both.
Both. Maybe Colin less so, but in this particular case, just referring to Colin because he was part of that little protest event.
Right. Okay. Well, we don't have too much longer to wait. We are actually within the 10-week mark here. So yeah, exactly. I don't have a countdown on my phone that I'm waiting to come up. No, of course not.
I've not already turned down two Thanksgiving events. You know, would you like to come out to? No. Hey, we're having a big party. No, screw you. Go away. 75 minutes of my life, you just can't talk to me. I don't exist.
Yeah, phone's going off, computer's getting shut down. My whole house is going into zombie apocalypse mode. Yeah. But, yeah, so it's coming quickly. But before that, we've still got one more day of Torchwood to get through next week. And we're on the downhill slope. We can do it. Just, you know, plow through this last one.
Oh, but thank you, by the way, for all the folks who have been chiming in on this and have been walking through this experience with us, or I should say rewalking through this in many cases. Haven't heard from anybody yet who have been watching this for the first time day by day in order to hear our discussion afterwards. I know we have a couple of listeners who are going to go through all of it and then listen to our 5-day discussion of it to kind of see how it matches, but we have not gotten their reaction yet.
Yeah, not yet, but
I'm keeping the crash card nearby.
So that means we're not even done with this. When we are done with this, we'll be talking about Children of Earth for weeks to come.
No, see, that's why we're recording it, so when they come to us saying, hey, I need to talk about, no, we already did, you take this, you're on your own now.
Yeah. You know what, we actually addressed that in the cast. Go listen to this episode. I gotta go hug a kitten.
Yeah. So, yeah, but thanks to everybody who has been enduring this with us. It helps. The numbers help. For anyone that hasn't chimed in yet that still wants to, there's plenty of ways to get hold of us. You can find us on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio, on Facebook. You can send us emails at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Leave us comments on gallifreypublicradio.com/53. That'll be the show notes for this particular episode, and you can find all the news items that we talked about there as well. So head over there and check that out, and yeah, just get your thoughts in on this. So,
please do.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this has been episode 53 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, next voting season, remind me to look at the candidate's view on vaccines.
Vaccines.
It's just a jab. It's a simple jab.
And this is Melissa saying, 3-2-5-0-0-0.
Ah, screw you. And this is Kira saying, if I have to have something strapped to me for 40 years that brings me pure joy, it's going to look an awful lot like a bottle of Kentucky bourbon.
We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Alzi.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. Have something you need to say, something we got wrong, or something you just need to weigh in on? Send us an email at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also find us on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio, on Stitcher Smart Radio under Gallifrey Public Radio. Find us on iTunes, where you can leave us comments and reviews. You can also head over to our homepage at gallifreypublicradio.com, where you can leave comments on each episode and get into discussions on the things that we bring up. You can also keep up to date on all the latest news and what's going on in the community.
Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2013.
Because my heart actually kind of goes out to Johnson for being as blind as she is. No? Yes? No? Bueller?